Summer. It is almost possible this summer to believe I am in England, where it rains until July and then some more, not quite hot enough to be humid, and the grass, which should be brown by now, a vivid green. I hear the sounds of children's voices, the wind in the trees, even bat on ball, though not that click of leather and willow played out with tea, cake and sandwiches. The songbirds chatter to the butterflies who slip silently from tomatoes to clover, which almost look like daisies. Amongst the occasional dandelion, these, though, are not finches, nor thrushes, nor skylark, nor blackbird, nor wren. When I awaken from my idyllic nightmare, where everything is right but not quite right, I see the unfenced yards and siding-clad houses, which make me smile, thinking how close I came to believe I am in England this summer. It is almost possible. Gathered from the field. The lark, soaring sharp, reverberates, symbolic of a time and place as long gone as that lark will be, captured by the lazy modulation in a green and pastoral mode. The seasons pass by parishes marked by songs of finch and thrush. Hawk and falcon hunt a cotton cloud sky, whilst that last dying note sounds into silence. The young applaud the singer, and the old the memory of a morning chorus so glorious, a richness of atonal polyphonic sound, serial calls echoed and countered by kind in wrapped and folded random phrases. Discordant patterns and chromatic keys combine a crazy kaleidoscope never bettered by the masters of music, whose flutes and flues flail flat to the ear, foiled by the metrics of time and pitch, eclipsed by a simple song and a soaring soprano. A minor mode and those birds, described in words and in air for that time soon to come when they'll never be heard again. Sunday in the Park. It is Sunday, and the park is bustling, strollers arm in arm, alone weave amongst the balls and bicycles, whilst tiny people trip unheeded below the eye, dressed boldly in spite of fashion. Mothers and fathers sit anxiously, ignoring their offspring, munching, unheeding the opportune vendor's wares, gambling dogs ruminating on the remains. A busket trumpet's not quite in tune airs, fending away the sound of civilization into this fantastic isolation, where each player appears alone in a green meadow, a few trees, a sparkling river, and the appearance of silence. Keats House, Rome. In amongst the quiet stacks locked against the casual loss of captured remembrance bound in tooled leather, sewn into ordered cells, keys to be turned for the panopticon not to become an oubliette. Where the preserving gloom foretells the approaching eve, yet even with window and shutters closed against invading light, the sounds of the street rise reeking through the casements, curl around the fastenings, lovers' murmurings clip by, children cry amazed amongst the street vendors' flamboyant wares. Opinion tends for right, truth determined by volume and pugilistic brash. Above it all, summertime floats from a trumpet's bell, a mother's love singing knowledge to her children's hearts, the cycle of seasons, the rhythm of rivers, crop nurtured for reaping, absorbs the quiet library, eddies through the cells of the turnkeys, riffling for that elusive right, lurking in the tomes of tombs to be ordered into new, bound and sinewed volumes, cropped into controversy, tied into fantastical wares to occupy children, confound lovers, and steal in turn through cracks in the shutters and the edges of casements. Our yield.
Today I am joined by Alan Gillett. Thank you for coming.
Pleasure.
Alan Gillett was born in Edinburgh and educated mainly in Kent, while travelling extensively to Iraq and India. Alan's career took him throughout Europe, back to India and on to Singapore and Japan, with jobs based in various locations in the United States. In the USA, he founded with his wife, Rose Drew, a popular open mic in Wilton, Connecticut. Together, they began publishing anthologies of the poet's best work under the imprint of Stairwell Books. Returning to England, Alan and Rose founded the Spoken Word Open Mic. They continue to publish anthologies and collections as a way of encouraging excellent but otherwise unpublished writing. He is poet, writer, composer and singer who performs in the UK and USA. He has a following as a music and art critic and is known for his lyrical style based on internal structures. His observational poetry often highlights injustice and institutional irresponsibility. Alan also works with classical music composers. His poems have been set by various eminent composers and have been performed regularly in concert. Finally, Alan is also a musician who has been singing throughout his life, taking on the duties of choirmaster at a number of churches and, where necessary, writing the words and music for pieces to support the often depleted available resources. So I'm quite impressed by the sheer amount of activities that you have undertaken in your life and still carry on today. Could you please share with us how all these passions blossomed in your life?
Well, I suppose the first thing to be aware of is that I'm 600 years old, so I've had plenty of time to develop these sorts of passions and interests. I think that as an individual attempting to be a fairly well-rounded person, it becomes not too difficult to become involved in a number of different things.
Mm-hmm.
It is very easy for somebody to get wrapped up in a career and so wrapped up that they become useless. The career probably could be done by somebody else, mm-hmm. but the other things that you do can't. So right. The people who do things independently as volunteers or as composers or people who are interested in poetry or singers or comedians or whatever you have, whatever they want to do, those are the things which can't be done by somebody else. Mm-hmm. Those are the things which also enrich our lives, and they're also the things that make us a great deal more aware of what is going right or going wrong around us.
Is this how or why your poetry focuses on injustice and institutional responsibility?
That's very hard, because I don't think I ever made an intellectual decision to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The process, I mean, every poet works in a different way, and my process is to start at the beginning and somewhere along the line I end up at the end. Mm. And very often what I was finding was that I was getting these Roald Dahl-like twists at the end, where I was taking an idea and all of a sudden some spark would connect with what was going on, and then immediately in the last two or three lines you'd actually find the link with what was going wrong. All right. In the world around us.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think is your role as a poet? I mean, what kind of message, if you do have a message at all, you're trying to communicate? And why? What do you think is your role as an all-rounded artist, we can say, in today's society is?
I think that role is very much to involve people around. Both Rose and I have always tried to mentor people, encourage people to write, encourage people to do things. And we support people by giving them gigs. We've always found that if you give people a responsibility, their art improves. When we were doing our open mic in America, we would ask members of the group to feature. And the very act of going over the work that they had done, sitting down and thinking about it, doing their performance, always caused them to improve and do better. They became better poets just mm-hmm. by going through that process of just once sitting down, not just writing lots of individual pieces, but saying, oh, look, I've written all these things. Oh, there's an interesting theme here. Oh, I can do that. Wow. And then they write new material, which is better, stronger mm-hmm. than they did before. And I think that's what it's about. I don't think, I mean, like everybody else, I like people to listen. So there's a bit of ego floating around in there. But the ego is mostly subsumed by the reality that we want other people to be doing their best.
Mm-hmm.
It's why we run an open mic. It's why we publish. It's the backbone of everything that we do.
You wish to include?
Include, involve, yeah. Encourage, yes.
Yeah. You think that's important in today's
vitally
society?
Important. Yes.
Why is that?
When you sit down and listen to senior politicians sitting down and saying, you only have to learn four subjects and being a musician or an artist or a poet or a writer is a waste of time and we're not going to give you any money to encourage you. Well, where do they think all the people who do marketing come from? They have to learn to write somewhere. Where do all the people who are going to do graphics design come from? Mm-hmm. They have to learn the art. They have to learn composition. They have to learn... It's a nonsense. Mm. Everybody is needed. All the arts are needed. Mm-hmm. And that's why, in a sense, doing that is important, because we also have to get the message out to people that everything is important. Now, maybe a PhD in hairdressing might be described as not very exciting, but on the other hand, it is a difficult thing, and maybe there is something really important about hairdressing that people need to know and understand that improves the whole quality of people who do that job. So it's... In the end, when you sit down, you can't say that body is worthless.
Yeah.
There you go.
I do. I absolutely agree with that. How were you personally then introduced to so many different things, to poetry, writing, music?
Well, I went to a school where there was a lot of it. Mm-hmm. The school had an incredible music program, which I was involved with from the start. I was involved... Not so much writing then. I think that my function then was performing, composing, administrating. I used to administer a couple of the orchestras. I was the music librarian. I did a lot of recordings of events. So mm-hmm. I was involved in the arts very early on.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, then once you've been involved, you don't want to let it go. If you've been doing it right and if you've been involved properly, you don't want to let it go. So mm-hmm. that's essentially where I started carrying on.
Mm-hmm. And how does this really all-rounded education come through in your work? Like, for example, your poetry is described as lyrical and based on internal structures. Does this particular style stem from your musical expertise? Is this a way in which it comes through, or are there any other ways? Do you think that it enriches your work?
It certainly enriches. I think that the musicality does come from the music, but I've always been told that I have a dreadful sense of rhythm. So, but when I write, that's not there. Mm-hmm. I think that I was at school with some very well-known musicians, classical musicians now, and I certainly wasn't as good as them on the music line. So maybe they were inclined to tease a bit. Mm. But on the other hand, as I began to work through voice and began to look at poetry, its link with religion, its link with philosophy, its link with science, all of those things began to coalesce, and the reading became, the flow became important.
Mm-hmm.
It's that sense of rhythm and direction and cohesiveness mm-hmm. that probably comes from that. I mean, a piece of music has a structure. I mean, there's a sonata form, and that structure, because of that structure, the piece becomes a cohesive whole. Mm-hmm. So although my poetry is so-called free form, in the main I do also have form poetry, but it's free form, I still need to put some structure there so that the listener mm-hmm. actually then sees the thing as a cohesive whole.
Right. For example, what I really, really liked of the poetry that you've just read for us, or at least how I personally, it appealed to me, was how with words you basically paint sounds. I was absolutely astonished. Like, I'm from Rome, and you read a Keats's Rome, and you just go through this description of sounds that I honestly felt at home.
Yes, I can imagine you're sitting at the bottom of the Spanish Steps, and this is all going on. There's street vendors, there are acrobats, there are people. There's the rhythm of people, and yes, that's there. And I was there doing a performance in the Keats House, but in the evening, the place was shuttered down. Everything was sort of basically set off so that they could close up quickly when everything was over,
mm-hmm.
and you could hear the street coming in. You could mm-hmm. hear the world outside coming into this very isolated, very special, very unique space.
Mm-hmm. I can see how sound and particular music kind of seems to link all humanity together, to you in a way. So do you think that also reading poems out loud is an important thing? A bit more like a bit like playing a score. Is reciting poems as important, as valuable?
I'm not sure. I mean, one of the difficulties is I hear a lot of poetry read on the radio, Radio 4, for example, and I just wish they had got somebody who had read the poem before they read it. this sort of actor BBC delivery of poetry is not always the most brilliant. But yet, on the other hand, when doing poetry in the public, the performance is extremely important, because you are still, in the same way that a musician is, you're still trying to engage the audience. You want people to listen. You don't want people sitting shuffling their bottoms in the audience because they're bored. You can sense it. Reading it out loud is also important, particularly in front of an audience, because it also informs you of the success of the poem. So that in the process, a lot of poets will, after reading a poem out loud, they will have that feeling. I describe it as it's like walking along a tightrope and you suddenly drop. You know, that there's that scary drop of walking across the floor and suddenly there's a weak floorboard and the thing drifts. I can feel that drop. If I feel that, no, I know that line needs fixed. It's just a sense that it's not working there. It needs to be sorted.
Is this also why you have an open mic? You built up two open mics, one in Wilton, Connecticut, and now one here in York. Is this more or less the reason why you decided to establish an open mic?
It's partly. I mean, I've been going to open mics for a very, very long time. I did one. I used to go one for the first time when I was still a sort of fairly neophyte poet. To one in Dulwich that was run by Alasdair Ashton, who was one of the poets who knew Waugh and Spender and so on. So he's listed as a significant British poet. And he basically drummed into me there the first time the importance of performance. And I've been going to open mics ever since, because, yes, I want people to hear my poems. I want feedback that says, "Oh, I like that poem." You know, nobody likes to do work any more than you, any more than anyone wants to do an essay and get back a 58. You know, I want 60s and 70s from my audience.
That's sitting right here.
But at the same time, though, going to those open mics did two things. One of them, they helped me to improve what I do, and secondly, they helped me to understand that the performance itself is a feedback. It encouraged me to write more. Oh, wow, we got one next week. My goodness, I haven't got a new poem. It doesn't always work, but...
Well, at least the stress-induced productivity is good.
to some extent.
To some extent.
We started our one in Connecticut because in America, distance is nothing. You know, you will drive an hour and a half, and that's local. But the open mics close to where we were living at the time were somewhat disparate. One of the ones that we'd been going to a lot had closed, that was fairly near, and the other ones were up in Yale or down in New York City, which was a great palaver to have to go down to. And when Borders opened a new shop in Wilton, we said, let's get there before anybody else does. And we were welcomed, and we were there for 2 years. Before we left the States. And then when we came here, there were no poetry open mics, absolutely none. And so initially in cooperation with Aesthetica, we ended up with two new open mics. There's ours and another one called Speaker's Corner. We have actually just celebrated our 10th anniversary in January. It was our 10 years. Now, that's pretty much a record.
Wow.
Speaker's Corner.
Congratulations.
Speaker's Corner is still running, but they had a year's hiatus, so we. But it is. I mean, to do that is incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
We have some friends who ran a weekly open mic in America for 17 years, and that is an enormous, enormous effort to have somebody in a certain place at a certain time every Wednesday is quite a considerable undertaking.
I can imagine.
They failed a few, because when America gets snow, it gets snow. But just to do a monthly open mic is quite a lot of effort too. If you're not going to be there, and because Rose and I are married, it does mean that occasionally we have to be somewhere else at the same time. Mm-hmm. We have to get subbed in.
Right.
We've only done that two or three times in the 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Does it pay off though?
Yes, enormously. Mm-hmm. Enormously.
In what ways? For you personally, if you want to share.
For me personally, because we've accumulated a lot of good friends, good writers. For me personally, because we've become more integrated into the York culture. You know, we're involved with some of the theatre companies, we're involved with International Women's Week, we're involved with the Literature Festival, we're involved with the 50-plus Festival, we're involved with the Library, the York Explore, doing projects with them. So we are integrated and involved in what's going on in the city. So we have our fingers on one of the pulses.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes, and we're involved with a lot of the art galleries, which is something else that we work closely with when we can.
Mm-hmm. So going back to something you said earlier, you said that even these open mic are for you an occasion to personally improve yourself and write more. So is poetry to you a sort of activity which is both personal and communal at the same time?
Yes. I know you want a fuller answer than yes. I think that the personal thing is that once you get to write a poem and it's not that easy. I mean, yes, I can sometimes. You say I need a poem about such and such, and I've done certainly poetry to order for certain things. Some of it's pretty drivelly, I have to say, and some of it's not bad.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, when things are going on around you, the time to stop and write can sometimes be very difficult. So when I look over my poetry reading book, I can see, you know, some years there's only 5 or 6 poems. It's amazing. Other years have got 20, 30 poems.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the luck of the draw, in a sense, of what's going on, how busy I am, how, I don't say how contented I am, but in a strange way, because if you're too stressed, it's very hard to write. People do tend to write because they're cross or angry about something, but if you're too angry, it's not worth it. What you write is rubbish.
Mm-hmm.
You need to sit back sometimes and wait for 2 or 3 months and think back, what was the essence of that issue before you can start to write about it? I need just to disconnect from activity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as publishers, I'm very busy doing and putting books together, so sometimes I just don't get the time to sit back and do it.
Mm-hmm.
But quite a number of my poems, for example, when I was in America, were written in a diner.
Mm.
I didn't mind the noise going on. I didn't mind someone coming and constantly filling my coffee cup and the noise that's going on. But I was disconnected from my normal world.
Mm-hmm.
The apartment I was living in, all the work I was doing, so that I could actually sit back and relax. It's an odd experience, because when I sit down, I've done it, and I've written 3 poems consecutively in an evening, and I look at them, there's a similarity about these.
Right. To be honest, in another 3 of the poems that you've read for us today, Sunday in the Park, Summer, and Gather from the Field, I personally felt this sense of peace, to be honest. I felt they were very quite peaceful. I enjoy them very much. If you want to share, could you tell us where they come from, if you remember how they came to you?
I can tell you pretty much most of them. Summer came from, it was the last year I was in Norwalk, Connecticut, sitting out in an Adirondack chair in the front yard and just listening to the sounds around me. And quite a number of poems have come from that, just taking the environment that I'm in and describing it.
Mm-hmm.
And giving it some structure and form.
Mm-hmm.
So Summer was very much that, sitting there in an environment where literally I could have been in England, except when I looked around, I wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
The sounds were not, as I say, the sounds were not quite right.
Mm.
And I was not there. There was noise, there was background that was not right. So that actually is the background to this one. And ironically, this one has been set by a York University postgrad. Now a PhD, Ed Cain. So there is a setting of this particular song. He did it with a Samuel Barber-esque accompaniment setting to it. Mm-hmm. And it occasionally gets done at Late Music.
Oh, wow.
Gathered from the Field, ironically, came from a concert in the Jack Lyon Centre of the music by Trevor Hall. So I was sitting and listening to English folk music. And again, with my musical background, Holst's melodies, Vaughan Williams' melodies, and a number of major English composers all have this folk music background. Some of them, mm-hmm. I think Vaughan Williams even collected folk music. That particular concert then highlighted to me something about a form that is going. We're dying. I mean, those folk songs are slowly disappearing. We're moving towards rather vacuous pop background music in as our mainstream. And it's sad because there is so much of our history in our folk music.
Mm-hmm.
But it also highlighted that a lot of those folk songs describe a world that doesn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And included in that are the birds. And you don't hear birdsong in any way like the amount that you used to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because there are less trees, there are less copses, it is amazingly quiet in a way that years ago you would always hear chirruping birds.
Mm-hmm. And by writing this poetry, you are sort of preventing its disappearance?
It's a very dangerous question to answer because every generation thinks about the generation before and listens to them bemoaning change. And at the same time, in amongst there, people are noticing things that are not as good as they were. Well, I've been aware of global warming since the 1950s, and I've been utterly flabbergasted that nobody has had any effort to do anything about it. And we're now 50, 60, 70 years after the phenomenon has been known, documented, and everybody agrees, we still can't get agreement to sort something out. We just sat and wasted a good 50 years where we could have been doing something, or we could have been negotiating something, or we could have been educating people. But now we're actually seeing the reality.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, yes, a number of my poems document things, changes which are, to my mind, extraordinarily dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other changes going on which also bothersome. And again, I've written about it, is the things like mega institutions. We have a huge NHS hospital trusts. We have huge city corporations. And we've broken away from the old parish structure. And there have been consequences. And one of the consequences is that young people are no longer as interested in politics as they used to be. Our young politicians used to learn their trade sitting in an urban district council chamber, learning and making their mistakes in a small chamber, and then they would work up to the district councils and then the county council and maybe go on to Westminster.
Mm-hmm.
All of that training is gone.
Mm-hmm.
MPs go pretty much straight into Westminster. Very few of them have any council experience.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that we've lost is accountability. Mm-hmm. MPs are, with their one-on-one, one-man, one-vote system, accountable to the people that they represent. Local councillors are not. My district has three councillors. So they all play the not me, Gov, try him game. So you can't get anything done because there is no accountability.
Mm-hmm.
All three of them are my councillor, and to get any one of them to pick up any of the issues that need to be dealt with is you have to bang their heads together.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially what we have both there and at the European level is that the people we elect are not accountable directly to the people who vote for them.
Mm-hmm.
Their accountability goes back to their party whip's office, and that, I think, is really dangerous.
Right. So your poetry, you think, also sends a warning about this change by...
I do try.
You do try. That's one of your... Is that one of your messages, one of your aims?
Yes. Certainly more recently, when I've become very much more aware that it's not just a trend that doesn't matter, that it's a trend that does matter.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one that you wanted to talk about was Sunday in the Park.
Mm-hmm.
That's a combination of the Sunday in the Park with George. There's a Seurat painting, Sunday in the Park, and the Sondheim musical. At the same time, this was set in the park by the river in York. So I had the museum gardens in mind when I wrote this, but obviously some of these things, some of the images that are there come from the Seurat painting. So it's a meld between the Seurat painting.
Oh, that's very interesting.
You know, the Sondheim musical and the... But I was curious because actually when I looked at this, there are a couple of images in there that also pop up almost with the same words in the Keats House poem.
I really like how you embed nature in all of your poems. Is it important that we sometimes go back to this nature, that at least we recognise that it's there and it's living with us?
It's important because as people, we resonate with the land on which we are. If you think about it, I think we all resonate with land, even though years of political manoeuvrings have tried to break that link.
Mm-hmm.
So the nature, the land, the place we are, I think we all have a sense of place.
Mm-hmm.
And it is that sense of place that I think every single one of us needs to get linked back to. We need to belong. We should be working in the same place as where we live.
Mm-hmm.
None of this taking a train for 3 hours. Every morning and 3 hours home every evening, because you lose your connection with place.
Mm-hmm.
But the important thing is then your whole family loses that connection with place.
Mm.
And we have this politicians who sort of bleat away about family values and so on, but it is meaningless if they don't do something to keep families together.
Mm-hmm.
And families are not mum, dad and two children. Families are aunts and uncles and grandparents, and sometimes to close friends who live nearby. It's a cohesive group of people living in a similar place, which actually provides a place of safety for the children to grow up safely. We don't do that anymore. We are very isolated, and as a result, our children are very isolated, and they don't grow up with any sort of street smarts. They don't grow up with any sense of cohesion, because school is a pretty horrible place to build relationships, really. And then what do? We send them to university, which is another isolated element. I mean, here we are in a university which, to all intents and purposes, it offers two fingers to the rest of the city and says, go away, we're not interested.
Mm.
So it is, even the students here are isolated.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important.
Mm-hmm. Is that why, to quote the poems exactly, mothers and fathers sit anxiously ignoring their offspring? Do you think that there is isolation within the family itself?
Oh, hugely. Yeah. Hugely. I'm not sure that was specific, that, but it is, because I was describing what happens in a park where the adults talk and the children run around at their feet. And it happens at a party, it happens in garden parties.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, there is an isolation. In a sense, years ago, I caught this when I used to drive up from South London across town to go visiting on a Sunday morning. When I first did that, which we're now talking about early 70s, there would be no traffic at all. Yet there would be people lining up at the bus stop. And then 10 years later, you could hardly get across London because of the traffic. And it brought home to me something actually quite important. When young people grow up and get married, they tend to settle, you know, not too far, but not too close to their parents. So they might settle 10, 15 minutes away. Now, that might be a walk. Now, a 10 to 15 minute walk isn't very far. And it isn't problematic. And then a little bit later, when the bus services, a 10 or 15 minute bus trip with a wait for the bus, maybe a couple of miles. But then when you get to the car, 10 or 15 minutes might be 20 or 30 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
So let's assume a family where there are two children. One has gone 30 miles east and the other one's gone 30 miles west. They're 60 miles away from... The siblings are then 60 miles away from each other.
Mm.
Now imagine the old days where a child could come home, come to school, find the house was empty. They'd pop round to Auntie Nora, or they'd go and see Uncle Bill. Relatives, cousins, they would play with their cousins. They live nearby. You can't do that now because there aren't any family members. You can't leave school or come back from play to an empty house and... you have to find somewhere, and it could very well be the house or home of someone who is not as well in their family interests.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, we have lost that link with family. We've lost that closeness.
Mm-hmm. Going back to your occupation as editor.
Mm-hmm.
So you, with your wife, Rose, you both direct Stairwell Books. How do you go about choosing pieces for publication? Like, what is your work as an editor?
I suppose the trite answer is with difficulty, but it's a question of ourselves trying to figure out what it is that we want to do. We started doing this very much as a means of providing a platform for the poets in our open mic. I mean, both here and in the States, we found that we had amongst us some extraordinarily good poets. And many of them, because they were in a small town in Yorkshire, had never been published or seldom published, or themselves couldn't see the quality of what they were doing. And so we did our first book in the States, and then we did, essentially after a couple of years, we did one here, which was sort of like it's planting a seed that has grown and and grown. This last year was the first year that we haven't produced an anthology, mainly because we found we'd overcommitted ourselves. So that was the one thing that we could drop without. And probably it was a good thing, give people a break. That what we were doing was that initially. But on the other hand, poets tend to be poor by definition. And we were doing very short runs, and we didn't do it to make a profit. But on the other hand, we didn't also intend to sink our life savings into doing short runs of books. And some of the books have been quite successful around the power of poetry to communicate. So that's all really tied up in with publishing. It's about bringing people to the public. It's about encouraging people to do things better. And publishing people is part of that process. When you're published, when you see people's reactions, it spurs you on to do better, different.
Definitely.
And so that's really the what's going on behind it. The large publishing houses, and I talked about gigantism, they have become gigantics in themselves. And so they're run by product managers. You know, someone sits down and says, right, here's a book with X, Y, and Z. We think that will sell 10,000 copies, so we can offer so much, and so we can publish and produce this. Poetry by relative unknowns does not sit there. You can't print 10,000 copies and sell more than 100 of them. So the economics are wrong. The other side of this equation is the Amazon and the Lulu view, where people self-publish. The problem on the self-publishing side is that you have to be extraordinarily disciplined yourself. And not everybody has the skills to recognise what is the right approach. So it's very easy to produce something that is quite good, but not brilliantly good, when a good editor or a publisher working with them can hone what they're doing. So we add value as a small press publisher, but at the same time, we're only going to add value if you are prepared to play the game with us, which is you've got to go out and perform. More books are sold on the back of performances than anything else, because they're there to put the passion behind. Oh, and get a signature, you know, and get a signed book.
A great plus.
But the small press publishers do and put some added value. The relationship with the author is not close. You're already living in a culture where our view of the world is bounded and crafted by Twitter and Facebook, which is also a form of self-publishing. So where is the critical side of the whole thing? Where are the people who are sitting back and looking at this, and looking at what you do, looking at what we write, looking at what we think, actually then taking that back and helping to, I was going to say, craft our culture, but it's not quite that. It's a two-way street. But our culture has become extraordinarily populist. And in a sense, it's not wrong, but it's not self-critical.
But one last question before we go. We hope this never happens, okay? But if you were stranded on a desert island and you were given the chance of bringing with you just one book, which book would you take with you and why?
I hate that question. And I sit back, I can never really put my finger on what's a favourite. And every time I choose it, I second guess it. So what I decided on was perhaps to pick a book which has had a major influence on me. The book I think I would take would be Robert Graves' White Goddess, because it is so rich, and you can read it again and again and again and get something new from it.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for being here with us. It has been great having you.
Thank you very much.